Okay, well, after Mal's talk, my mission was clear, which was to explain as best I can how we know what we know, how those measurements are made, and what they do or don't tell us about neutron stars. And I'm going to try to cover a lot of ground. There's more than just superfluidity and superconductivity that's of interest to a broad audience. And so I want to discuss quite a few measurements that have been made of neutron stars, first bringing you up to speed on things that we've learned in the last 20 years, and then concluding with more recent work on the discovery of extremely highly magnetized neutron stars with fields of 10 to the 15 Gauss, the magnetars, which is one motivating factor for having this meeting now. Let me start by, in some sense, trying to address a few questions. One could ask, why bother? It's always a good thing to try to answer. What's the purpose in studying neutron stars? And there's actually two answers to that. And it depends on who you are. And actually, in some sense, it defines who you are. it's sort of a bit like Kennedy's famous line, which is, you know, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Same thing applies to neutron stars. Physicists tend to answer, ask not what neutron stars can do for you, but what you can do for neutron stars. And astronomers tend to invert that, in the sense that to astronomers, neutron stars are useful for other purposes. They're probes, they provide good timing that tells us a lot about the intervening interstellar medium. Whereas to physicists, they potentially provide labs for learning quite a few bits of physics. And the examples of that are countless, and I hope to give you some of those today. So let me start by first explaining where neutron stars come from in the context of stellar evolution. So these are the compact remnants of stars more massive than about six to eight solar masses. So let's just say more massive than about 10 solar masses. So this is the end state for massive stars, stars 10 times the mass of our sun. And as most of you know, those stars die via supernovae. And the simple picture of neutron stars came a long time ago when astronomers, for example, Zwicky made the claim that at the center of supernova remnants should be found such objects. Now, the first thing I have to explain to you is why, even though the star that makes it is 10 solar masses, why the remnant is much smaller. And rather than give you a full lecture on stellar structure, which is not the point of this, I just sort of have to tell you the answer, and that is that for these stars that are this massive, the endpoint of stellar evolution is, in some sense, I'm going to call it the construction of an iron core of 1.4 to about 1.8 solar masses. Okay, and everything ends at iron because beyond iron, of course, you can't fuse the nuclei to release energy. And so the star, in some sense, dies or can no longer live on burning nuclear fuel once it's turned its core into iron. What happens at that point is basically the only way the star, of course, is still losing energy. And at this stage of stellar evolution, it's losing energy on a sort of a month time scale because of strong neutrino emission. It would be a great neutrino source if they were nearby. But because of the continuous energy loss, of course, the only way it can match that is to keep contracting. And what happens at around this mass, and it depends on the mass of the progenitor as to what this mass range is that basically the nuclei start to dissociate. That costs energy when you start to dissociate nuclei. And that leads to the inexorable collapse of this object to a very dense core, which has a density of order nuclear density. So the collapse of this goes to density of order the nuclear density. Okay, and that event is what makes the supernovae. That event is what powers the ejection of the envelope. And of course, there's a strong emission of neutrinos here, which were seen in 1987 indirectly via order 20 or 15, that told us directly that the mass, that the binding energy release is of order 10 to the 53 ergs, as we expect. Okay, so that paradigm is pretty clear. And what I want to start telling you is, in some sense, the part of the conundrum is the parts we understand have been reasonably well confirmed. I'm going to already start to show you a puzzle about the mass distribution, because the predictions from the theoretical understanding of the collapse tell us there should be a range of neutron star masses. And as I'll show you, that's even not borne out by observations.
How do we know sometimes we don't get a black hole?
Okay, great. So what about black holes? Okay, so somewhere up here, if you read your old textbooks, they'll say 30 solar mass stars make black holes. We no longer think there's such a clean distinction. The reason for that, let me just say it and write it down, is that it's not always the case. That the collapsed object sends out enough energy to unbind the envelope. And the envelope, in this case, is the other 6 or 8 solar masses or 20 that's sitting out there. So if that happens, then this material falls back onto the neutron star, pushes it over the roughly 2 or 3 solar masses that we think is the maximum mass, and makes a black hole. Okay. So for example, 1987A could well have made the neutron star in the initial bit fall back over the intervening day, month, or years, turn it into a black hole. That's not a crazy hypothesis. It actually might even be true. Hole at late times. Okay, so that's the answer.
Are the calculations of the collapse good enough to give you the statistics?
No.
How can you find one or the other?
The problem is the following. This releases of order 10 to the 53 ergs in neutrinos. Of course, that doesn't do much to unbind the envelope, but if you could tap some small fraction of that, the gravitational binding energy of the envelope, the outer envelope of the mantle of stars, 10 to the 51 ergs. So it's that 1% you need to tap, and that's hard because they're neutrinos. Okay, there's ways to do it, and you know, different people will get different answers. But by no means is there some understanding of when they tend to do it or not do it. It's clearly more difficult for the very massive stars because the binding energy of that envelope gets very big. Okay, so in the simplest picture, you'd say more massive stars, it's tough for them to unbind that envelope because whatever goes on in the interior doesn't really know that it's got to unbind 20 solar masses or 5. And if that mechanism is always the same, then maybe it's harder to make a neutron star out of a massive star.
So that phrase, not always the case, depends on all kinds of complicated variables like rotation, chemical composition, and so on.
Absolutely. So even under the probably unrealistic calculations of no magnetic field, no rotation, people can't agree. Okay. So that's the mass distribution. Let me just give you the simplest calculation of the radius of a neutron star. Okay, and this, in some sense, is going to be a case where I ignore nuclear interactions. I'm just going to remind you of the simple problem where it's just degenerate neutrons balancing the hydrostatic pressure. Okay. So we have to just balance the hydrostatics, which is, of course, that dp dr is minus rho times gravity. But this then just gives us the pressure divided by the radius is like m over r cubed. That's the density. And gravity is, of course, gm over r squared. Okay? So the pressure at the center is roughly G m squared over r to the fifth. That doesn't look right. Fourth. Okay, so that's the pressure at the center. I'm not going to give you that in CGS. It's a big number. Or in EVs per cubic centimeter, whatever you want. If we balance that, let's just balance that with degenerate neutron pressure. Okay, well, that pressure is going to go like the number density of neutrons times their Fermi energy. And I'll just tell you that the Fermi energy is not relativistic for the neutrons. It's a few hundred MeV. It's not up to a GeV. Okay, so then we know how this scales. So this is NN times H bar squared K Fermi squared over two neutron masses. Okay, and we know how to relate the Fermi momentum, the Fermi wave number, to the density. So this just goes as n to the 5/3. Okay. So many of you have probably seen this for white dwarfs, brown dwarfs, or you pick your favorite degenerate object. Okay. What do we get? And I'm going to put back in the fundamental constants just to show you why things aren't the way they are. Okay, so if I put in the number density, of course it's going like rho over the neutron mass, and plug it through, what we get is that the radius of the object is roughly h squared, Planck's constant, divided by, say, the neutron mass to the 8/3, 1 over to the mass to the 1/3. That's a relation you've probably seen if you've done this before, and then there's a g, big G. So this r going like 1 over m to the 1/3 is what you always see for stars held up by non-relativistic degeneracy. Why is it relativistic? It is a very deep potential well, the neutron star. That's a good reason to study it. Well, that's, of course, gm over rc squared. That's v over c, v escape over c squared, if you want. What's this number? Well, this is, I'm going to write in a suggestive manner from this formula, is gm squared over, say, h bar c squared, the mass of the star, and units of the neutron mass to the 4/3. And this looks funny. But this you might recognize. It's, right, if I put in, this is in some sense a fine structure constant for gravity. Okay, instead of e squared over h bar c, it's g times m squared over h bar c. Okay, so that is a very small number, but this, of course, is a very large number. Now, this thing ends up being of order 1, and so you might be shocked as to why that is. Well, of course, the star, to survive, actually knows about all this physics, except the proton mass rather than the neutron mass. If you actually ask what a solar mass is, for those of you who don't know this, it's a convenient way to derive a solar mass. You can impress your friends. Roughly, a solar mass is where alpha g is this fine structure constant. See, if you work through stellar structure and ask how big does a star need to be to actually successfully burn, it ends up being proton mass times this gravitational thing to the minus 3/2. Okay? So that's a different lecture, but this thing all ends up then being unity. Okay, you can see all the alphas cancel, so this thing's order unity. Okay? So the coincidence is really not, there is no real coincidence if the star that's makes a neutron star is a star that had to burn, then they both know about these constants, and so this thing ends up being word unity. Okay? So they're relativistic objects, and that's the simplest way to understand it. Okay. So that tells us that the radius is going to be of order 10 kilometers, and now let me start showing you a few things. Let me first stop to see if there are questions at that point. So let me just show you an old example of mass-radius relations and then get into observations. These are mass-radius relations as constructed for different equations of state. I just want to show this to you to give you a sense for the scale. Again, it's this 10 to 15 kilometers. These are for different nuclear equations of state, how you want to handle the nuclear interactions, because that is an important piece of the equation of state. What I'm showing here is a schematic of the observational current limit range on the mass. As you can see, basically, I'm not going to discuss radius measurements because they haven't actually told us much. In some sense, they haven't allowed us to exclude equations of state. I am going to show you, however, the data on this very narrow mass range, which is a puzzle. So here's the current set of observations of neutron star masses. These are all radio pulsars, objects I'm going to talk about next. many of these you know are from the relativistic Hulse-Taylor pulsar. But as you can see, the range is extremely narrow. Okay, there's no evidence for masses in excess of 1.45, and this distribution is well modeled by a narrow range of neutron star masses, as I've shown. And so the first thing I just want to say, here's a major puzzle that actually has not really been solved, is why is it when stellar evolution tells us there should be a mass range, we actually don't see any evidence for it whatsoever? I'll give you a possible speculative solution, which was sort of propagated by Jerry Brown and Hans Bethe, is that this happens to be the maximum mass of a neutron star, this 1.35. And so the reason you see no more above that is that if you have a bit of fallback, you turn them into black holes. That's a great hypothesis because it's easy to falsify.
Minimum mass and minimum masses.
So the minimum, sorry, okay. So I didn't explain that. So what sets the minimum mass of a neutron star, so there's two answers. One is you can't make one less than 1.4. We don't know how to do it. Okay. Theoretically, the lowest mass is around 0.1-ish. That's when the neutron, difference in neutron-proton mass is comparable to the binding energy, gravitational binding energy, so the thing becomes unbound. If all the neutrons suddenly turn into protons and electrons, the energy you release exceeds gravitational binding energy. So that sets the minimum mass. So that's around 0.1.
But between 0.1 and an order of magnitude.
But I'm saying we don't have any way to, we have no way in stellar evolution to make a 0.1 solar mass neutron star. So it's sort of a moot, it's an academic point.
So that is also the lower bound of this
fine. Oh, so the lower bound is you know, this is not far from what the lower bound is, actually. Yeah. Actually, someone should correct me if they know, but when I last looked at the predictions for neutron star masses and evolution, this is actually near the lower bound.
It is sort of curious that in 1930-16, the difference between the two, low and small, is larger than some of the other ones. There is some intrinsic dispersion.
Oh, yeah. No, there is some dispersion. That's right. Yeah, the point I want to make is there's nobody at 1.7. Yeah, Gary?
Do we know the masses of any neutron stars that aren't radio pulsars?
Yes, but less well. It's a much harder game. And in that context, for the accreting systems, which I'm not going to show you, there is evidence in one case where maybe the neutron star mass is 1.7, but the error bar on that is pretty big. Okay. So we do know them in other contexts. But they're much harder to measure. These are the best measurements.
So the dispersion could be solid in accretion?
So this could be fallback. I mean, if you think there's a mono special number, then the dispersion could be fallback. The problem with any of those hypotheses is why does a little bit fall back, not half a solar mass?
Another problem with that hypothesis is that there are claims that all the binaries in which there are black hole candidates, all the
right.
black hole candidates
yes.
are six or seven
right.
solar masses, so there's
yes.
a big gap right. between the two.
That's right. That's right. So what Brad's bringing up is that black hole masses have been measured in other systems. They're around six. There's no black hole mass around three or four, or even two. In which case, it makes it hard to believe that there's two or three solar mass black holes. Okay, so it's not a solved problem. It's what we're going to do in the next few months. Okay. Nobody's signing up. Okay, so that's the state that's basically the limit of our knowledge on equation of state. And at that point, it's a good place for me to bring up a few things that need to be measured, where it's not the theorists that are slow, it's the observers or the technology. So let me mention a few things that have not been measured that would be extremely important before I move on to radio pulsars. So what's not been measured? Okay. Let me first give you the one thing that's not been measured that I think will be measured in this short period of time, which are the radii. as many of you might know, to measure the radius of a star is difficult. What you can best do is measure the solid angle it subtends on the sky. Right, if you really want to get the radius, you have to know the distance. Okay. So what you can well measure is a solid angle. And that's been done in a few radio pulsars and also in other systems. So you can measure, in some sense, R over the distance quite well for a few thermally emitting neutron stars, which I'll discuss in a moment. Neutron stars, which says you just need the distance, need D to get R. Okay, and there's some hope in a few cases. The most talked about case is a nearby neutron star for which the distance is going to be pinned down by just parallax. So the old traditional method of measuring how much it moves on the sky as the Earth orbits the Sun. And for that object in particular, there's a good thermal spectrum. And once they've measured the parallax, then they should just get the radius. Okay, and that sort of should be carried out, for, I would say, for a few objects. And this progress is because of X-ray telescopes like Chandra and XMM that are flying right now that are making these measurements. So I think there's hope to get the radii for some neutron stars. Now, the problem is for none of these, you have the mass. So you can't, you only have one axis on that, one point on that plot. So the other crying need is to measure something much more exciting, which is the gravitational redshift. Squared directly. Okay, that's not been done.
Nice.
Yeah.
What is the status of attempts to measure the radius from the gravitational bending?
You've got to know the angular distribution of the photons at the surface, so.
And if that is poorly.
For the thermal emitters, you probably should be able to do something there. Yeah. Yeah. But that really depends, you know, on really knowing the thermal emission. Actually, this does too, so those two should go hand in hand.
Wavelength of the parallax is
measured? This is for the nearby object, it's with Hubble. It's actually bright enough in the optical that you can do it with Hubble. Okay, and Fred Walters has been doing it. Actually, he'll talk about this at the conference. He does have a result on this now, so hopefully that'll be discussed at the conference in October. The other thing you'd like to do is directly measure the gravitational redshift. By that I mean see a spectral line that you know and love, but is rich redshifted from its energy at emission. The problem with that is that neutron stars tend to be hot enough that most things are fully ionized, okay, and strong enough in the gravitational field that they tend to stratify the elements. So that if you have some neutron star sitting, it tends to stratify gravitationally. It has just hydrogen at the surface. Hydrogen is, of course, the easiest thing to ionize. And so it's very difficult to get an atomic line. So there's been no progress here. So for atomic lines, it's hard. You could also hope that maybe some gamma ray line could be observed. The difficulty there, so for example, some nuclear excitation feature from some element, or for example, deuteron formation if you're breaking up nuclei and forming free neutrons. The problem with that, of course, is that you need to measure things in the gamma rays, and that our sensitivity is just not there yet. This, of course, would be great, because this gravitational redshift is a very constraining property. So I would say we don't know much about the nuclear equation of state in terms of how it affects the global sort of mass radius relations. Okay.
Are accretion density helping?
Yeah, if you can identify some feature and you think you know it's the Kepler orbit at some radius, then yes. So for example, there are claims of features that people identify with the Kepler orbit of a particle right near the surface of the neutron star. Periodic features. So some you see some timing signature that you believe very strongly.
Gives you radius.
Right, right. So you can play that game. And that actually, that is constraining. Okay, I'm not really going to talk about it. But. So I am definitely making a selection here. Things I trust. I guess that's on tape. Okay. Okay, so I haven't mentioned superfluids. Let me start talking about the first place where superfluids come up, because I know that's more of an interest to this crowd, especially after Mao gave his beautiful talk about all the intricacies of superfluids. So what I want to discuss now is neutron star cooling. And that is that basically what we call after birth. Okay. The neutron star is hot. Okay. And cools mostly by neutrino emission. By hot here, I mean, say, 10 to the 10 Kelvin, say. And you'd like to observe, not the neutrinos, you'd love to observe the neutrinos. You observe the neutrinos from the very birth event, but what I mean here is over a time scale of years or millions of years. Okay, so the neutrino emission there is nothing you can detect directly. So all you can measure is the surface temperature of the neutron star and expect to see that if the core hasn't cooled down too much, the surface is still radiating. So these neutron stars you get to see from the heat just from the birth, and they're typically faint, and most of the progress observationally that I'm going to show you that's been reported so far. The satellite that was called ROSAT, the German-American X-ray satellite, made a lot of progress, and I'm going to show you data directly from that. Progress on the observational side. And I'll show you those data. Let me first, though, talk about the emission mechanisms. And a little bit more in detail about what is the equilibrium in the interior of the neutron star. So it's not pure neutrons. Okay, and the reason for that is just that the neutron would decay, and so you've got to have enough protons and electrons around so that the phase space is blocked for the neutrons. So there is a slight abundance of electrons and protons. Okay. So the combination of charge neutrality and beta equilibrium tells you that the chemical potential for the neutrons is the sum of the chemical potentials of the protons and electrons. Okay. So this is the simplest possible neutron star. I'm not going into ones where I have other stuff happening, quark condensates, exotica, as we call it, just because this problem is hard enough. So if you're at T equals zero, and this is your equilibrium, then of course there's no way to emit neutrinos. There's no way, if you're at T equals zero, the Fermi levels are you know, filled up and then completely blocked. And so you can ask, how can I even possibly cool this plasma? Okay. Well, a way to cool the plasma is to have a slight finite temperature. And that's the case you're interested in anyway. So when T is not zero, but let's say still KT is much less than the Fermi energy, okay, there is phase space for neutrino emission. Okay. And the simplest possible thing you could write down is really just the neutron, in some sense, the neutron decay or the electron capture, right, is that one, or the inverse, of course, of the other side, except bring the neutrino to the other side, because okay, there's no neutrinos around on this side of the equation. So just bring the neutrino to the other side. Now, how does this happen? Well, this happens because when KT is not completely zero, there's always a little bit of phase space very near the Fermi surface, right? And this is what's called the Urca reaction, named after by Gamow, after a casino in
Rio.
Thank you, Tony. Because of its ability that you enter with your money and you leave with none. Okay. And I think it was sort of named because you can see that if these reactions are going on, the neutrinos you make are escaping to infinity. So the constant shuffling of the neutrons and protons in their Fermi seas is leading to energy loss because the neutrinos you make are escaping to infinity. Okay, so that's the sink in this problem. All right, so the neutrino emission high sync. Okay, and this is what's called, you'll see called the IRCA process. Okay, now, the problem with this process...
So what's the IRCA process? It's the same amount of
material
as a magnet.
Yeah, so I was right, sorry, let me just write it down. So the other reaction, right, is this going to neutron plus... What's that, right? Okay? So you're emitting, you know, neutrinos, antineutrinos. Okay. Now the problem with this is the following. Sorry. So in Mao's talk, for those of you who are here, he discussed superfluidity in the neutrons and the superconductivity in the protons, and I'll get to that in a minute. Okay. All right. So what's the problem with this? Okay. The problem is the following. If these particles are all near the Fermi, so these particles that are participating all have momentum of order of the Fermi momentum. Right? So electrons, protons, neutrons all have, that are participating in this, okay, all have T of order of the Fermi momentum. Okay? So if you want to have this process happen, the neutrinos, of course, are only carrying away excess energies of order KT. Right? That's all the energies the neutrinos are carrying. So neutrinos leaving with E's of order KT's, and so their momentum is of order KT over C. So the neutrino momenta are varied, and this is much, much less than the Fermi momenta of all these particles. P Fermi for anybody. You pick who you want. Okay? So the difficulty is momentum conservation with this process. The neutrinos basically carry away no momentum, in which case this has to conserve momentum amongst the three particles. Okay? So I can just remind you of a way of the problem is the following. Let's say that's the neutron momentum. Okay? Imagine the proton has this magnitude and the electron, you know, has this magnitude. You see you've got a problem. Okay? The sum of the electron and protons have to add up to be at least the neutron momentum to even have a solution. Okay? All right. Otherwise, basically you can't do this because of momentum conservation. Okay? So that basically requires that the magnitude of the electron plus the proton has to exceed the magnitude of the neutron to even have a momentum-conserving reaction. Okay. Okay. Well, this here's the problem: is that so charge, as I said, we are charge neutral, right? So that means Ne is n proton, but then of course their Fermi momentums are the same, right? They're both spin 1/2 particles. Okay. So Pe equals Pp. Okay.
What's the Fermi energy in numbers?
I'll get that number. Oh, sorry, but it's around 100 NeV ballpark. For the neutrons.
So that's 10 to the 10? No, in degrees K?
I usually don't think.
NeV is
10. So,
12.
Okay.
So it's 2 orders of magnitude higher than the temperature.
Oh, yeah, the energy, that's right. So the energy scale is much, much higher than temperature. Okay, so this says that basically, so 2. P proton has to be bigger than P neutron. And then when you work out for the degenerate C, what that means, of course, is then that the number density of protons has to exceed the number density of neutrons divided by 8. Okay? This is just from P going like N cubed, right? Okay? And most equations of state, when you work out the beta equilibrium, don't satisfy this. Okay, now Ray is always correcting me.
Well,
now's your chance.
Some do. I'm not endorsing them, but
okay.
probably list both possibilities.
Right, so I will, okay. So the typical problem with what's called direct IRCA is just that the equation of state typically has n proton less than nn over 8. So this neutrino mechanism is blocked, this claim. Neutrino mechanism is blocked.
Don't you get two neutrons to decay?
I think you're one step ahead of me. Well, not decay, but I'm going to show you a spectator, basically have an extra neutron come in as to solve momentum for you. Okay, so you just go one higher order. I don't think that's cool. Okay?
Why can't the neutrino come out with an energy much greater than KT?
So if you have to remember, you're always dealing with being in this balance. So you could say, well, gee, why can't I just, this looks fine if the neutron decays. But the problem is, if that were the case, then it's a once, you're not in beta equilibrium. All right? So remember, you're starting off, you're in beta equilibrium, and KT is small relative to E Fermi. Okay.
Before you show us that the nuclear equation stays as huge uncertainties, and
we're not going to show you that.
The point is that even with all that uncertainty, getting involved in total sense.
No, there are some equations of state that do satisfy this constraint.
Oh, I see. So
there are some. There are some. There are some.
In which it is.
Yes, yes. Okay. There are some that allow this. Okay. So the solution to this problem, okay, is to just allow for an extra, say, neutron to participate as a third body, just to solve momentum conservation for you, right? So you just add a neutron to either side. Okay. All right. Now, of course, that costs you a lot because it costs you in phase space by KT over E Fermi twice. Okay. So let me give you the punchline for that. Okay. This is called the modified IRCA. You don't need to know that. There needs to be a casino that's less efficient. Of course, there is none. So maybe that's why they didn't get one. What's the characteristic cooling time for that? That's roughly. Actually, I think I wrote down the wrong. Let me not give this. I think I have it wrong. I wrote down the wrong relation. Do you remember, Chris, at 10 to the 9? I think I've got the IRCA. It's around the 10 to the 4 years, 10 to the 9, 10 to the 3 years. Yeah, I wrote down the wrong number. I'll show you plots, actually. So let me show you. So let me not worry about that and just show you the result. So the modified IRCA is what's typically used for the cooling. And now let me give you a sense of why all this matters. It matters because there are observations. And as always, that's where it comes in. And then I'll get to the superfluent. So what I'm showing here are observations of these young neutron stars. On the x-axis is time. And here's 1,000 years, 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5. This is for a 1.3 solar mass neutron star. On this axis is the surface temperature, okay? Basically T effective, the thing that sets sigma T to the fourth. This is 10 to the 5 Kelvin, here's 1,000,000 Kelvin, okay? And the neutron stars are shown here, and there's 2 points plotted for each neutron star. The points that are the red points are where you fit a black body curve to the spectrum. Now, in reality, a neutron star is not a beautiful black body emitter. You really have to calculate an atmosphere. When you calculate an atmosphere, the temperature changes. So the green points are the ones you should actually trust. Those of you who are colorblind, it's the lower points.
So those are zero field.
And these are zero field. Thank you, Chris. Yes. And these are zero field. The atmosphere is a zero field models. And these are not zero field. That's right. So the modified IRCA process would follow this dash line. Okay, that would be the prediction for a 1.3 solar mass star, how it cools with time due to the neutrino emission from the core. So this is the surface temperature, and what you have to calculate is the coupling of the surface temperature to the core temperature, which I'm not going to really discuss.
What's modified? Okay, that's the two.
Sorry, that's this one.
The right. And yeah. Original IRCA would be?
Original IRCA on this plot would look like this, actually. Roughly. I didn't have a plot of it, but it's. Oh, there's plenty of plots of it. I didn't bring them. It's pretty bad, okay? So if you had direct IRCA, I would. So I'll say it, and then somebody can correct me. I'm pretty sure direct IRCA is ruled out. No tomatoes, okay? Okay. So this is what the modified Earther would tell you. And what I need to just briefly say, because I don't want to spend too much time on it, but it is a place where superfluids come in. I'll give you another place where superfluids come in. And this literally I learned about yesterday, even though I'd been told by Chris Thompson a year ago, is that people had rediscovered a paper by Flowers, Ruderman, and Sutherland from 1976. So I was only 12, so I'm not responsible. Which was cooling due to a superfluid effect. And let me just say it. And it was just forgotten, basically. This paper was forgotten, as far as I can tell. It was rediscovered in 98. Okay? What the paper said is, once you've gone into the superfluid state, but you're not so cold, you're not at a 10th TC, maybe you're only at a 3rd TC, there's, of course, then constant formation and breaking of Cooper pairs. Okay? If you ask where the excess energy goes, you guys can tell me where it goes in a crystal. Okay. Photons, I presume. Okay. Same thing here, except it goes into thermal energy, but some small fraction of the time, you emit a neutrino-antineutrino pair. Okay. So there's a branching to a neutrino-antineutrino pair of that excess. So the underlying process in... you want me to... I'm not going to be able to draw the right diagram with all the... You can figure it out in the next 20 minutes. So I don't want to try to wing it, because I did just learn this yesterday.
Okay. Well, it's easy, but still, it's just right. Using the interactions with the other stuff to get the energy balance, and that reaction sort of, it's not so different from modified ERCA in that way.
Well, but the rate is quite different than the modified ERCA.
Oh, sure.
Right. Okay, so the analogous case that one could mention in astrophysics where it comes up is, for example, if you have a pair of plasma, you don't always have the E plus E minus go to photon, some fraction of time to go to neutrino, antineutrino. Okay?
See, this is a neutron superfluid. So
yes.
The neutrons, of course, are not charged, but it does have a magnetic moment. So is there some remnant or trace of the Meissner
effect?
Well,
I don't think so. So we should have somebody talk about this, and I'll alert everybody to come. The curves with that included for a high TC, of course we've got the market on it, of 10 to the 8.3 Kelvin looks like this. Okay? So the enhanced neutrino emission from that process makes a big, big difference at these times, at 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 years. And the claim is that wouldn't happen if there was no superfluid. All right. It should be this pulsar, 0822 minus 43.
That's not a problem.
I don't know. Yeah. Leon.
Okay, I'm backing up to a stupid question because I didn't understand what process we're even talking about. So you have a superfluid of neutrons.
So
pairs
right.
of neutrons forming Cooper pairs.
Right.
So are we talking about a quasi particle, which is an unpaired neutron, that decays, and somehow the presence of the condensate allows you to satisfy?
So it's something with the fact that you change the dispersion relation because of the gap being present.
But it's an unpaired neutron that decays.
I don't understand it well enough. I don't understand it well enough. Maybe Chris can.
Well, I mean, two neutrons which are initially unbound, bind together through a Cooper pair, and the energy released is compared to neutrino and antineutrino.
So that's the process. It's really
that's not this process. Sorry.
So for astrophysicists, you could have free emission, or you could have free bound emission.
Yeah, there's some finite energy up in all of the particles.
Well, you, yeah, okay. All right. So as I knew, I would not get done in time. Okay, so that's a place where superfluids come in the sense, in the crude sense of that, to compare to the data you have to worry about. I wouldn't claim that's evidence yet. I'll talk about the evidence at the moment, which are glitches. So now I need to switch gears and discuss radio pulsars and how we know about magnetic fields. So those data I just showed you are, is energy, where the power source is the initial thermal content of the star. But I now want to talk about a radio pulsars, where the power source, in this case, is the loss of rotational energy. Okay, just due to a misaligned magnetic dipole position. Misaligned mu, in this case, the mu is the chemical potential of the dipole. So the energy loss rate for just dipole radiation, if, let me write it in terms of the dipole, which is misaligned from the spin axis of some star, which is spinning at frequency omega, is just 2 mu squared, omega to the fourth, sine squared beta, that's the angle between mu and spin, divided by 3 c cubed. And of course, this equals I omega, omega dot. Okay? So what the observer measures in a radio pulsar is omega and omega dot. Okay? And being bold, they infer mu. Okay? So let me show you what that gives you these days. Correct. Well, they can model and try to get theta. But for the number of pulsars I'm going to show you here, there's been some standard sine squared being the proper thing for uniform angle, uniform random angle. Chris. But I can't, huh? Okay, I can't show. I hate doing being a striptease, but in this case I must. So let me do this before I turn it on. It's dangerous, water soluble. Okay. So this is P dot. Of course, they always use P dot rather than omega dot. Okay? Versus period. So this is spin period of the neutron star. This axis here is 1 second. Here's 10 seconds. Here's 1 millisecond. 1 millisecond is roughly the as fast as you can rotate a neutron star before it breaks up. And this is P dot. OK. The lines that have magnetic fields on them, 10 to the 13, 10 to the 12 Gauss, are where that omega, omega dot, and that formula for 10 to the 13, 10 to the 12 Gauss would be. Okay? So the presumption is these stars have fields of 10 to the 12, 10 to the 13 Gauss, just from this observational line. They spin down, of course, because of this. And so we can also calculate roughly their age, which is how old they are if they started at very rapid rotation of order a millisecond. And that's these lines. Here's 10 million years, 100,000 years, and 1,000 years. Okay, the objects with whatever this thing is, it's not really a star. 4 points. Stars have 5 points. You guys are too tired for jokes. are in supernova remnants. Okay? So these are objects that are in supernova remnants. All right. So I'm showing you this first just to give you a sense that pre-roughly 1995, the sense was that neutron stars had fields of order 10 to the 12 Gauss. Yeah. They are associated with the supernova remnant. That you can see. Absolutely. Pardon me? No. Sorry, I should make it clear. These are
the young ones.
These are the young ones where the remnant hasn't dispersed. Okay. Or the neutron stars, I'll show you, hasn't left. Okay. Neutron stars get born with very high velocities. Okay. So this is just to remind you of the fact that we actually see, Crabbe's an example, see neutron stars in supernova remnants, so that sort of simple story is true.
Why is this that there's a throwaway remark about neutron stars being born with high velocity?
Well, I'll show you in a minute that they leave the galaxy. A word a third leave the galaxy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They're a lot of fun. Okay. So most at this time, you see the sort of the simple statement that most young neutron stars have fields of order 10 to the 12 Gauss. I'm not going to discuss at all the millisecond pulsars, but there is a whole population down here with lower fields, 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9 Gauss, which are very rapidly rotating. Okay. Let me just briefly say, what's the evidence that this story, or this identification of P dot with the magnetic dipole is even true? Okay. Is it true? Well, But the best, let me give you some examples of where we know it. The first thing to say is that these are found as radio pulsars. The energy in the radio is much, much, much less than that E dot I wrote down. Okay. The evidence for that large E dot mostly comes from looking at remnants like the crab, where you see in the inside of a remnant a large population of very non-thermal particles, which have presumably been accelerated by the deposition of this E dot in the form of either pointing flux converted or pointing flux or pairs. Basically, this E dot is thought to come out in a pulsar wind, which we don't observe directly, but we see the heating in some sense of the remnant. And that's the best confirmation of that E dot. Okay, I'll show you this plot more in a minute. So what we don't have a radio pulsar where the B field is, say, 10 to the 12 Gauss, and we can go down and have a direct measurement. So how is that done? How do we have any idea the neutron stars actually have fields this high? And for this, let me just briefly write down one formula, which is what is the electron cyclotron energy if the B field is 10 to the 12 Gauss? Okay. So that's, of course, H bar EB over MEC. Okay. Okay. Well, at 10 to the 12 Gauss, this is about 11 kilovolts. Okay. And we'd like to then go, of course, and measure a series of cyclotron harmonics, for example. Okay. That would be nice. That's been done, but it's never been done for one of these systems. It's been done for neutron stars that are actually accreting. Let me just show you that, just in case you're a complete cynic and don't want to believe this. Let me show you cases where it has been measured directly. And that's an X-ray spectrum. This is not a radio pulsar. It's another type of neutron star, whereas you can see, basically, there are cyclotron harmonics. In this case, I actually wrote down the formula to remind you, it's actually about 10 to the 12 Gauss. Okay. So it's a beautiful spectrum, X-ray spectrum in this case, from an Italian satellite, DepoSats. So roughly speaking, we have pretty good confirmation that neutron stars can harbor fields this high, 10 to the 12, 10 to the 13 Gauss. And most of them that we detected are radio pulsars. Okay. I mentioned neutron stars are born fast. Here is a recent summary of this from Cortis and Chernoff. Dave Chernoff's here, so he can explain the plot if I can't. The best one, this is the cumulative distribution. Let's just look at the bottom plot. Let me first remind you that, so this is velocity on this axis, and this is the differential distribution. That's the cumulative distribution. So 500 kilometers per second is roughly the escape speed from the galaxy. Okay. Most stars in the galactic plane are sitting way down here at 20 or 30 kilometers per second. Okay. Neutron stars are, you know, have mean velocities much, much higher, 400 or 500 kilometers per second. Okay. That's something we don't understand. It's most people are focusing on, of course, the original event and whether or not some asymmetries in the collapse could lead to a small kick. In terms of energy, this is no big deal compared to what else is going on. Okay.
Is this theoretical
current? So no, this is the sort of best fit to the current data set. Where's David? He's in the far back. Is that a fair assessment?
Correct.
So, of course, this muddies the waters a bit for the associations, because at some point you leave the association. But I just wanted to let you know, this also means that many neutron stars have left the galaxy. It doesn't take that long for that to happen, for them to get out of the galactic plane. So they're exotic in that way as well. Okay.
So this means that in the intergalactic space, that all these neutron stars zipping around, do they do anything?
So there's not a lot of gas to accrete. You might want them to accrete some material and maybe light up that way, but there's not much out there. The mean density and the...
So they just...
No, yeah.
This has an impact on people who are stellar, the galaxy.
Well, yeah, I mean, most, well, it depends on which metals, but so The board, though, I mean, most of the metals are deposited in the plane, you know, so 1/20th of the mass leaves, goes to infinity, but the other 1/19th of the mass stays in the galaxy. So, well, it definitely gets the kick at birth or a few years thereafter.
At the explosion.
At the collapse. Well, so we don't know. Okay, it's I can give you stories. A story is that after the collapse, there's roiling convective motion. Okay, the last chunk of material that came in, there's no reason for it to come in at the center of mass. If it comes in slightly off axis, that could not only spin the star up but give it a kick. Okay, as an example, but it's not a lot of energy.
But it's also important for neutron star models of gamma ray bursts. Models in which it's all for the gamma ray bursts associated with neutron stars as a refraction ones, they could not be associated with galaxies just because some of them get ejected.
Okay.
And most of them are associated with galaxies, which makes it less likely to associate with neutron stars.
Okay. So let me talk about one other bit of radio pulsars that actually potentially lets us say something about the superfluid, and that is what we call glitches. So the formula I've written down and erased says that there's some very slow rate of loss of angular momentum. And so if you were to observe the pulsar, and life were simple and relatively boring, then if I plot frequency versus time, it would just be some smooth curve. Instead, what happens for neutron stars with ages of 10 to the 3 to roughly 10 to the 5 years is the following. You're staring, looking at this object, and suddenly you see what we now call a glitch, which is now I'm going to magnify the scale up. Okay, so now imagine I've written this plot accurate to part in a million, because you can make measurements that accurately. What you see is a sudden jump. Let me draw here. A jump. Okay, with delta omega, which is typically about 10 to the minus 6 of the spin. Okay, that's easily measured.
So, Lars, you should probably say that not all neutron stars in that age range exhibit this behavior.
There are very few exceptions, as I'll show you. Actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So you see a jump, and then after which you see typically a decay, and some go back to exactly the same new dot, the same torque, but not all do. And I'm not going to talk about this piece today. So what is this? Well, this is a sudden spin up of the neutron star by a part in a million. Okay? So what you see is a sudden spin up. Okay. And so there's some delta J, there's some I, delta omega. Okay. And what's the source of that? Well, let's have a hypothesis that the source of that is the superfluid that isn't completely participating in the spin down of the star. So there's a loose bit, which for some reason suddenly likes to transfer its bit of excess angular momentum relative to the star to the star. So if that's the case, then we can ask, what's the net rate of transfer? Because in these systems, you see many of these glitches year after year after year. And so you can ask, what's the net transfer from all those glitches of angular momentum to the star? Okay. All right. So I can write down something, which I'm going to call this excess J of T, which is just the sum of these delta J's. For all the different glitches, okay, the moment inertia is presumed to be constant, the accuracy we're doing this at. Right, and I can plot this up. Okay. So I'm going to write the formula over here. Okay, because this is actually, as you'll see, it's a rather nice way to plot the data. Okay. So what you're going to see plotted is this cumulative of all these glitches, okay, relative to I omega, the total angular momentum of the star. Okay, so this is, I'm going to write this down, this is going to be what you do is you take the data and you sum the delta omegas over just the omega. Okay, what do you get?
Is it an I ruled out?
No. So sorry. And this has been done by very many people. I'm just taking a plot from a paper by Bennett Link and company. This is for the Vela pulsar. This is exactly that sum I just wrote down, this sum. Okay, and here are all the glitches. Chunk, 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 chunk. Okay. And then you can ask, you see this is linear in time. Okay. Zero order, linear in time. Okay, you can do this for many different systems. There's another one, actually, which has data, which is, as I'll show you in a minute, is actually comparable to this. And then you can get a JDOT. And you can get a net rate of the spin up due to this compared to the spin down the pulsar usually has. Right? So you take this parameter that you measure, right? Okay, that's J of T. Take the time derivative, that's the torque, and compare it to the spin down, the net rate spin down. Okay? That's shown on the next plot. This is the ratio. This is a really bad choice. Big G is the ratio of those two torques. Okay. And this tells you, in some sense, the moment of inertia in that loose bit. Okay. So here's Vela. This is from their paper. Here's Vela. Here's my update of this pulsar, which has since had about 10 more glitches. It's now sitting there. Instead of there's only one or two glitches before, it's sitting here. And this is as a function of age. Sorry, here's age on this axis. So this thing's 1.4% for Vela. It's 1.2% for this other pulsar. So that point I updated. And here's Crab sitting down here. As you can see, Crab's not nearly doing it. And here's another one way over here. So my statement, Andrew, and there's other plots which I didn't make, which bear this out, is that I don't know of any system sitting down here without an error bar that's this big.
And the diamonds are also the large errors.
Okay. All right. So what does this tell us? So this says the loose bit is of order 1% of the moment of inertia. Okay. And this is just going to get better, by the way. Hopefully we'll see much more of this at the conference, because literally this was me taking data from Andrew Line. So hopefully we'll see this discussed quite a bit. So this is only becoming really clear in this form pretty recently.
Glitches seem to occur at regular intervals. So was that a log point? No.
It's, well, I mean, the problem is there's only four sources. So two of them, it's pretty regular. Uh-huh. I mean, Vela and this other guy are actually pretty regular, but not all of them in that way. Let me just say it, because I'm running out of time. The most likely loose bit is thought to be the superfluid in the crust that Mal Rudeman discussed, the superfluid that is in the inner crust of the neutron star, where it's thought to be paired in a spin singlet state. It's in a place where the vortices are in a medium where there's a lot of nuclei, so a lot of pinning sites, if you wish. So most of the theory of glitches has been built on a hypothesis that it's that piece. You can calculate what the moment of inertia is of that, and it's about 1%. Okay. So definitely to astronomical accuracy, this is the best evidence for superfluids. And hopefully that accuracy will just improve with time. Okay. So if I've got 10 minutes, David, I will give you the exciting stuff. Okay, so that's in some sense what we've learned over 30 years. Now I can tell you in the last 10 minutes what we've learned in 5 years. I think that's actually fractions about right. Okay, so the populations of objects I've discussed are ones we see because they're tapping their rotational energy or because they're hot from birth in some sense. The big recent observational breakthrough has been the prediction and discovery of neutron stars whose energy source is most likely the decaying magnetic field. Okay? And let me first write down a formula that gives you a sense of how this can happen. And one of the prime people who made these predictions is here, Chris Thompson, so he will correct me when I misrepresent the situation, or at least he'll cover his face. And you can take the formula I wrote down for the spin down, okay? And you can ask the simple question, if that formula holds and I go to high magnetic fields, of course you spin down much faster. And you can ask, at what time is it the case that the energy in the magnetic field, just the B squared times R cubed, is bigger than I omega squared? Okay, so for high magnetic fields, you can imagine as you dial the field up, you spin down faster, you get rid of the rotational energy more rapidly, but your magnetic energy content is big. Okay, so these objects have a name, which really helps. Okay, they're called magnetars, and Chris Thompson and Rob Duncan were the proponents for these types of neutron stars. And so what I'm going to call E in the B field exceeds E in the rotation when the following is held, that the time exceeds roughly 1,000 years, okay, for a typical neutron star. And a typical, I'm not going to put in the radius scaling, but this goes like 2 by 10 to the 14 Gauss over to the 4th. Okay? So after 1,000 years, a 10 to the 14 Gauss star will be dominant. Its main energy content, it's not to say you can use it, but its main energy content will be the magnetic field. Okay? Now, what was the trigger for worrying about these objects, or claiming that such objects existed? Well, as usual, it was observations. And it's observations of a class of objects that were found in gamma ray burst studies. So you've all heard about gamma ray bursts being in high redshift of order 2, 3, or 4. Okay. There's a small subset of those objects, small 4, 5, which are called soft gamma repeaters. And what they are is, just as I said, they repeat, unlike all gamma ray bursts. Their spectrum is much softer. It's only 100 kilovolt photons instead of typically 30 kilovolt photons instead of an MeV. And their distribution is that they're in the galaxy and or the Magellanic Clouds. Okay. So those things made them distinct as a class. And one part of the puzzle was that the first one that was the humdinger in this class is had a very large gamma ray burst on March 5th, 1979. And we now know that that object sits in a supernova remnant in the Magellanic Clouds, and this shows the error box from the March 5th event. This is from Chris Thompson, sitting in, this is the case of the X-ray remnant. This doesn't look so dramatic, but there's also known to be a soft X-ray source there. So this is clearly something sitting in a supernova remnant. Okay, that's the only point I want to make here. And during this big outburst, not the little repeaters, but the big outburst, there's a periodicity seen. In that case, of about 8 seconds. I just forgot, okay, about 8 seconds. So the puzzle was the following. Let me just give you my perspective of the astronomical puzzle. Is I have an 8-second spinning object, which is presumed to be a neutron star, okay? But it's sitting in a remnant that's actually pretty young. So a question is, how did it get spun down to 8 seconds in such a short period of time? Well, the simplest solution to that hypothesis is the field is so high that it gets spun down because of the field time. Okay. Right. Now, of course, the confirmation of that hypothesis would be a measurement of the p dot of the changing spin period being what's expected. Okay. Let me first show you what these large outbursts look like, because they might worry you and your family. This is another pretty much carbon copy from another soft gamma repeater. These are big, rare outbursts they had. This is the counts in some detector. It doesn't matter for now. Going basically off the chart, okay? And then there's an afterglow, and you can see there's a nice periodicity there, okay? So the spin period of the neutron star just screams at you, okay? But the flux from this at Earth, since this is kind of fun, was strong enough to turn the ionosphere, the ionization state of the lower ionosphere, into the day level, okay? So people worry about gamma ray bursts extincting us, and so the ionosphere got messed up. This was actually in on, well, this is again from Chris Thompson. This just shows a beautiful observation, which is their bouncing radar, and I don't understand exactly what they've done, but I'm not going to worry about it. Here's daytime, nighttime in some level. Okay. Here's the event. All of a sudden, this measure goes way down to the daytime level. Here's a plot of this is their data measuring the ionization state of the ionosphere. And here is the afterglow of the burst. Okay, so there's no doubt they're correlated. Okay, the ionosphere is messed up. Yeah, that's sort of just a curiosity. Okay, so the reason that we now believe that this hypothesis that these objects have high fields is actually true is really from the measurement of the period derivatives. Okay? So the periods are measured, but you really want to see the rate of change as expected. And again, let me show you, this is from Chris Thompson. These are the soft gamma repeaters. Two of them now have the p-dots measured. Okay? And I'll show you on another plot. These are very high p-dots. The implied dipole field, if you just use the formula I wrote down before, is of this order, 2 by 10 to the 15 gauss. Okay? And there's another whole population, which I'm not going to discuss, which has a different name, but basically is also of a class where the B fields are potentially high enough that that's the energy source. So on this previous plot I showed, where I was doing a striptease, you can now put those objects on there, and there they sit, because P dots have been measured. Okay. So this has all happened literally the last 3 years. These are both the soft gamma repeaters and the SGRs. Here's 10 to the 14 gauss, roughly 10 to the 15 is here. What's also happened at the same time is that radio pulsars have also been discovered, and these are two, with high magnetic fields, so this, there might not be such a gap. And as you can imagine, people are very interested in comparing these two objects, which aren't that different. But there's been a tremendous sort of opening up of our phase of what we consider to be high magnetic fields. 10 to the 15 gauss is still much, much less than equipartition. Okay, just to give you a sense of what's possible. The last thing I want to show is that in addition to these super outbursts, they have these repeating events. Okay. And the energy source for those is not known, but let me just show you a plot comparing the time distribution and the energy distribution of those flares to something all of you should be familiar with if you live in California, which are earthquakes. So on this top plot is showing the number of bursts with a given waiting time, so the time between these events. So this is from a soft gamma repeater. Okay, so as you can see, they're well distributed in time. There's very rare, you know, very rare once in a year event compared to once every 1,000 seconds.
This is one single object, right?
This is one single star. You can also look at the distribution, the cumulative distribution. From that object, it's the line, and this is again from Chris. This is the soft gamma repeater, it's that object. And on top of here are earthquake waiting time distributions on different sites. I guess, Chris, you might remember all these. So CA is presumably California, and UT?
Utah.
Utah, okay. YS? Someone else, okay. Okay. So the waiting time distribution, actually, in here, there's no scaling. Okay, so you have a good sense, like I said, of the frequency of the expectation of the events. Okay. Big ones are rare, thank goodness.
Is that just the statement that the top plot looks like Gaussian?
Yes. Well, this is coincidence.
This is the same
Sorry.
Data, right?
Sorry.
No.
This is the same data. Okay. Okay. This is waiting time in days. Sorry, you can't read this back here. This is 10 days. Okay. Here's 1,000 days. Okay. Here's a tenth of a day. This is just half. This is the cumulative distribution. So half events occur with the time less than half, a tenth of a day. Okay. The energy distribution of these objects does have to be rescaled to compare to earthquakes. Okay. Here is the energy distribution: 10 to the 40 ergs, 10 to the 42 ergs. Okay, this is the number of events, the distribution, which has especially lower energies. And now this has gone on, how many orders of magnitude lower, Chris?
Four.
Okay, so there's data now going 4 orders of magnitude lower. These are the energy distributions for earthquakes. Here's 10 to the 20 ergs, so wimpy things. Here's 10 to the 22 that wakes you up. California again. So it's just making a suggestive analogy, okay, that the energy source for these might well have something to do with the elastic crust that we think is there. Okay, something Ian now sort of stated is that the crust we think is in a crystalline state, and for some reason it's getting sheared and stressed, and the presumption is that's because of the changing magnetic field. Okay, so at that point I'm going to...
Yeah. Does it remain?
I think it's a pure power. Yes. Yeah, you can't whisper, Chris. Yeah. So yes or no?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Okay, so I just wanted to close with this, which should hopefully get you excited. These objects are quite exotic. They probably are powered by the magnetic field, a lot of these bursts are most likely coming from elastic stress being released either in the magnetic field or the crust. And at that point, I'll stop. Thanks. Gary.
So your comments that the magnetic field of a neutron star can vary anywhere from like 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 15 gauss.
Yes.
Does it know what fundamentally sets the scale of what's
the magnetic field? So no, and those are the notes I skipped. So let me tell you what I would have said. If you, again, you go back 20 years, people just did flux freezing. They'd say, well, star has 10 gauss. What if it just flux freezes down? Okay. So that number doesn't give you 10 to the 15 gauss for normal OMB stars. It gives you 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10 gauss. Okay? It doesn't give you a big number. It depends on what you... We don't know much about the magnetic fields of the progenitors. Okay? So you can say, okay, well, what about... There are some very magnetic white dwarfs, actually, something that Jim Weaver is going to tell us about on Thursday, which are a minority of the population, but they have 10 to the 8 gauss. What if you flux freeze one of those guys and make a neutron star? Okay, well, then you get 10 to the 15. So there are some systems where you can, in some sense, that's not answering your question. It's just blaming it on, I just need to push my ignorance one step further. The things that have been talked about are, for example, dynamos operating in the proto-neutron star, okay? And something that Chris Thompson and Rob Duncan worked on 10 years ago was to try to understand why 10 to the 12 gauss, because 10 years ago that was the puzzle. And to paraphrase their long learned paper, the answer was not 10 to the 12 gauss. The answer was, why not 10 to the 14 gauss? Okay. In some sense, saying that the natural number from that sort of picture of a dynamo operating is a high field, 10 to the 14 gauss, not 10 to the 12. So, I mean, the state, we don't have a great theory for it, but I would say that the way people have tried to understand it, they don't get this 10 to the 12 gauss.
Aren't there a lot of phenomena which have the same power distribution as earthquakes, but which have nothing at all to do with...
I presume so. I presume sand piles and... Yeah. I mean, this was a paper in Nature, so you should all know. like all good magazines. Well, it's a magazine, yeah.
Oh, that has a
connotation. But
it's been confirmed. It's clear the observations are true about the power law distribution.
Right.
Okay. The analogy.
But you could have done it with, I think, power outages of the electric grid of different sizes. And you'd see
that one there might be a theory for, yeah. Mrs. Eyebrow.
Okay, well, that's not hard.